Thank you very much. While I'm talking just now to introduce this text, I want to take a reading of the sound. So if there's anyone who can't hear me at this level and way, let me know, and we'll try to fix it up. I've been out in California now this year at the Getty Center, very happily writing about death. And this is a little section I just completed, and that's why it'll seem, I think, what I call plain text. It hasn't ripened yet. It may not be old enough to hear, but I hope it will pass. I'll just say a word or two about the narrator, who is a middle-aged historian in the Middle West, whose specialty is Nazi Germany. He has suspicious leanings in that direction. His name is Kohler. He is in the 60s, writing this in the late 60s. He is reminiscing or thinking back about his master, a German professor whose name was Magus Taber, and whose ideas I have modeled a little after the German historian Treitschke. But otherwise, there's no resemblance, who is called by his students and everybody who knew him after the Bruegel painting of the woman plunderer, Mad Meg. So you will hear that this person's called Magus Taber or Mad Meg and so on. And this is about the death of his professor, whom he studied with in the 30s in Germany, around 37, 38, and is called At Death's Door. His eyes seemed unnaturally bright, as if there were no other stars. I suppose I had expected the standard, that is, the sterilized hospital room, empty of everything except the equipment of death, perhaps a few useless flowers, lots of white to flatter the patient's pallor by aping it. Certainly Meg was shivering in the center of a wide expanse of sheet, but otherwise the walls were brick, the courses gray from the years they'd been about their business, the single window small with an almost waxy pane, so that from where I stood in the open door, its view of the world was smeared. Paint on the sill had peeled without a beech's burn, and the floor of uneven stone felt more like one a medieval castle might put beneath your feet. Cold, too, though it was summer, and otherwise warm in the town. Oddly off-center, a solitary bulb, inadequately shielded by a green metal cone, hung from the ceiling at the end of a thick black rubber-covered wire, and when you pulled its beaded chrome chain, the lamp's shade swayed. I had not been summoned, so I appeared in death's door with some trepidation. One glance told me that Mad Meg would be mad no more, or rather, it would now be his body which would behave crazily, leaving his soul to lie still as a stage on which others trod. The air smelled slow as smoke. I did not understand then what it meant to be brought down by your own bones, though I had certainly observed the steps made by last legs, dragged against their will into making another move. I naively thought of it as learning to walk again, Aber all sob, but I know now that what I was seeing was the unmaking of a skill, the losing of the learning. Mad Meg wasn't to die in mid-cry, amid the consternations of his concepts, full of his own vinegar and other people's piss. He would die in his shroud, chilled to the skin and consequently cold to the touch, a cold which began within the soul and froze its way out. As he himself said, or tried to say, when you die this way, you die bit by bit. Death's rattle is continuous. First, perhaps, for the kidneys, but then for alertness, or it's your grip, and you can't make a fist. Your nails lose their luster, your speech its zip. You cannot easily wet your lip or see your shoe where it's slipped beneath the bed. And when you slide to its edge, the floor is so far away, as is every feature of a familiar face or the taste of food in bowls you have to holler at to see. While tingles try themselves out along your legs, which you haven't flexed sufficiently today, as you were told by the orderly, because you were attending a funeral for your fist. The ceremony seemed a bit hurried this time, and we're at that point where you tried to say something fitting about those formerly serviceable fingers, except the throat had become unusually dry, even for July, and appeared to be preparing to match the other humiliations of your illness with insufficiencies of its own. So soreness spreads in sheets until you have no real skin beyond this unpleasantly encompassing sensation, and even your ability to have a rest, a good snooze at least, is gone, and you begin to pass in and out of yourself like a fly, a room. That's the buzz your ears hear as they try to shut down, and you hunger for silence like a piece of cheese to soften in your mouth, though nothing any longer has a name, neither Parmesan on the pasta, nor Swiss in the trap, nor brie on the bread, nor cheddar melted over meat, nor chunks of feta among the greens. Moreover, you really haven't any hunger. Eating is the hospital's habit. You haven't any needs but the need to be released. And then you know you are a goner. Okay, go, you say. Let's go. But the going still goes on like the slow drip of a tap, your nose, your catheter, IV, and a breathe which sounds like someone crying out in pain. IV, IV, IV. Or maybe you are hooked up to other items of instrumentation, so the departure of your life reads like tables for the train. When does yours leave? But you are condemned to remain. They shall find you dead in your seat in the waiting room, bagged by your foot where your vials were stored, right hand open on your knee where it was trying to make a fist when you snapped like the snapping of a lead, always all of a sudden, damn. I did not know what you did in front of death, what you said to the dying, how you conveyed concern, whether you could be any kind of comfort, because those who had so far died in my life had died out of sight, behind, it seemed, dozens of doors. And I had simply sat in a rolling car and then on a folding chair till it was over, when somebody said, go play. Nor had I read about it much during my growing up, as many adolescents did, nor let my head entertain seductive thoughts of the beyond, flirting with what seemed so remote, so romantic, so unreal, there was nothing to fear. Little chance my winks would be misunderstood, my smiles lead to a mistake, that I'd be asked for a date and have to hold a bony hand during the last dance. Listen to the bones shake as I was doing now, that Magus Tabor had turned into his palsy, and not another symptom showed, but the paleness of the blur his body made, quivering constantly and uncontrollably, fluttering where it was loosely wrapped, the white sheet all he had to hide in, like a sail so battered by the wind, I heard the cloth snap. Yes, the eyes were alive. the eyes of a bad storm. And I tried to fix on them as they were fixed on me, but naturally their gaze had to seem accusing. Who knew what dared to enter them? Guilty, because I was not ill. I was upright, imbecile as always in his presence, on the brink of uttering inanities so complete as to bring a smile to his shivering, delight to his dingy demise, as he might have described it. Uneasy, though, skidding like a spoon across a greasy plate, and eyed apprehensively, as an insect might eye the approach of my foot. While I stood there in the door and almost said, "Say, well, how? I've brought you. I thought you might like any better. It's nice out today, not so warm." He could no longer form words. The air which reached his cheeks was in total turmoil and emerged in burbles between what were wiggling, worm-like lips, his teeth having been removed long since and for many reasons. One, that he was biting himself and his tongue became too wounded to say scream. Words were Magus Tabor's reasons for being. Breath was merely their carrier, their contrivance. Soul was essentially the source of one's logos as it had been for the Greeks. Consequently, this illness shook more than his body when it shook his larynx, trembled his emptied jaw, plucked at his palate, so that sis boom ba, had he said it, would have seemed profound. The final accomplishment of history's poet. And an instance of poetic irony, too, to have the soul go off in a raucous cheer, whistling away from both steam and kettle, the ghost in the machine, gone from between every round-down cam and lever where it used to lurk, escaping each murderous movement by means of irrelevance, but now irrelevant even to its own exertions. It was not as if, having lost his arms, he could still type with his toes. He had lost every medium for the spirit's expression, all but his eyes. The sorrow I felt, the loss I was realizing, was not for a life, of course, since Magus Tabor was technically still alive, but for that extraordinary consciousness which principally his speech was able to convey to me, as well as to haulfuls of others. How else would we have known what paced back and forth in Mad Meg's head, except from his talk, his lectures, his letters and books, those throatier roars? It's true, his body had been a burning bush, but it had burned with his message, his manner, his method, each wholly his, in the tone, taste, type, in the hiss and bite and venom of it, that made his utterance like a snake strike. Or as he so often said with typical extravagance, "I am my hymn." Listen to my four square tunes and be the same. Yankee are you, revolutionary, then be your own tea, Kohler. Pour yourself in the bay so Boston may sip you and be stimulated. That was when I hoped to return to Harvard, and he was full of ridiculous quips about my future, how I should plan what I should achieve. Well, whatever it was, I hoped not to end like this, in this last sadness, for I was sobered to the soul to know what the magic man had come to, how fate had finally betrayed him, denied him not only a hero's death, but in a way, any death at all, any dignity in his old age, any reverence, any even farewell from friends. The fact was that Tabor had no friends, and I had not been bidden to his doomsday doorway as if I were one. I had come on my own account to pay my last respects to what was left of the composer of history's hymnal, the singer of history's lays. What was left to respect proved to be his eyes, which roved when I did. I could not wish good luck or bid Godspeed. Hey, I hope you get to heaven. I think you've got a chance. I really do. And I could not utter the cliches which embarrassment sent to my lips. In fact, I could not say anything to someone unable or forbidden to reply, who could only tremble as if in fear, cower under the covers in shame of his situation, with his eyes glowing like an animal caught in a cave, alone, the last of his species, no longer enraged and ready to retaliate, no longer even brave. Could I hold out my hand and hope to sink its shaking with his? Could I break off a smile like a crust of bread, speak my mind, die quickly, my friend, let's get to death without the dance? No way to say, you leave one pupil, professor, among all of those who flocked, yes, like sheep, to hear you, who gave you their 1 minute of admiration at the end of every holy hour. From them you earned, possibly gained, certainly obtained, a single disciple, and you will die now, we both hope soon, before your lonely follower can disallow you, before he can go back on your word and besmirch your reputation with the tarnish which will surely darken his own. There's some luck in all of this. That stain, furthermore, will be your gift to him, a set of disturbingly honest and repulsively accurate ideas. For these, he comes to your deathbed now to thank you, for simultaneously giving value to and ruining his life. I stood beneath the green shade, soaking up its light like a towel and casting shadow in a puddle's shape. The nun who had accompanied me, who opened the door and said, "This way," had disappeared as if into her strangely winged hat. I thought this was an odd place for a professor to be, especially one whose gods all came from the Nibelungenlied, although I remembered that Santayana had hung out in a nunnery at the end. Surely Meg had not recanted his views, or had his beliefs as shaken as his body was, or taken those symptoms as a sign that because punishments were to be tailored to their crimes, his body would be consumed by ticks and twitches. Indeed, muscles jumped, lids flickered, conniptions folded his legs up to his belly, only to extend them spastically like a jolted frog. His hair seemed to bend and straighten in an otherwise unfelt wind. His thumbs wagged as if he were hitching two rides on one road. Disfiguring cramps grabbed his face, and sometimes I thought his ears wigged and his nostrils flared. How exhausting it must be to be so exercised. Laocoon's serpents were outside of him. Meg's were Meg. And now, how could Tabor be fed? Food would spew out of his mouth as fast as it was spooned in. Tabor's gullet would also disgorge it. Moreover, his head wagged and bobbed like a badly managed marionette. In an instant, tubes would be tugged from their fastenings in his flesh, were they tried. Strapping him down was not feasible. He would fidget in the loops, and even wrapped like a mummy, his interior would cringe and lungs deflate. I decided to appeal to his nurse to sedate the magus more severely, put him to sleep, overdose him into Nevermore land. So he would die as a disturbance. That was probably proper. but it was proper only when put this way, rather than another, which was something Magus Tabor had taught me. Wait for the words, he'd say, and then you'll know what is going on. Wait for the words, they will betray their occasion without a qualm. Wait for the words, when their objects will become real, turn real as a face turns red with the realization they are being said. Don't deal with the unnamed. They are nobodies. Remember, to be is to be syllabated. I was a word, therefore I was. And while I was a word, brief as a breath, or sustained on paper, prolonged in print, bound as a book, I was like Lickety, you understand, like a term on one of the tablets of the gods, like lights made of stars flicked on and off to say, here I am, I'm stage, I'm song, I'm printed on the ticket. So Tabor could die in 1,000 descriptions, although each way only once. Once as a disturbance, once as a sign from the gods, once as a penalty, once to signify the unfairness of fundamental things, once to be symbolic of his soul's strife, once to remind me of what he had taught, once to be simply another number in the census of the dead that day, the day, evening, midnight, dawn, he did it, it did it, died. The hall would be ababbled until that toy door opened, and then a hush would fall, expectation took control of us, and it was followed by intense attention. What would the subject be today? How would he begin? What was his mood? Today, Meg's mood was distant, undecipherable, hidden by his shakes. But perhaps it was wrong to imagine a mood existing while he was in the grip, one supposed, of such pain, certainly in the center of the embarrassment his body gave him. All right, his body gave me. So then, gentlemen, today we do not stand on the edge of tomorrow, as you might imagine. But we stand where we always stand, on the lip of the past, into which our spirits shall enter to become gods, the way Empedocles entered Aetna. Perhaps I misunderstood the situation. Perhaps he had become his speech, and right now his body was a vocal cord, twanging a brand new tune and telling the tale of time in an advanced experimental way, while I, inadequate as always, was failing to follow and rendering his efforts useless. My memory was made of old modes. He'd say, it is an ancient dream, a German dream, but do not suppose only Germans have dreams or that only Germans enter theirs. Not at all enter. It is just that some dreams resemble their dreamers and are puerile, paltry, personal, dressed in wet rags, gutter-fed and sewerish, because they are composed of the aspirations of servants, while others resemble the fluffy white and rosy clouds which painters have drawn to signify transcendence, the hole in the heavens through which Christ's body will pass on its journey to the throne of God. It is a road that we, here and now, replicate with rows of flags and our own ranks, parting for the passage of our leaders toward our goals. I walked to the window to look out, my gaze running away down the road, but unfortunately leaving the rest of me behind the distorting smear of the glass. I wondered if it would help to hear a groan instead of the rustling that went on, a sound which resembled something else I couldn't for the moment place, not exactly from my past, for I felt I might hear it again one day, something common, simple, from home, a robin turning over leaves while looking for grubs, a dry fall sound. That was it, a cross between a little rustle and a slight clatter, the audibility of insects. Mad Meg maintained that death was history's only subject, and he returned to it again and again, his rhetoric wrestling with doom's inherently indefinable lack of character. For death, he said, was vacant, final, universal. It was the quicksand into which the whole of thought sank. Its finality disposed of every goal and made every purpose pointless. Its generality did the cosmos in and all the gods. I knew I should say something, and so I finally did. I said, "Hello." I said I suspected he was surprised to see me. Not enough people knew where he was, I said. If they did, he would have more visitors. I said I hoped he was being well taken care of. I hoped he could eat. I said I did not recognize the order signified by the nun's habit. I asked one question. Did he ever sleep? Of course, I regretted opening my mouth, especially because in order to get anything out, I had to pretend to be in a play about hell and that here was one of the tormented I was scripted like Dante to talk to. I said that my work was almost over, that I would be returning to Boston soon, which was a lie because Harvard had not renewed my fellowship, that I admired the new Germany, that my experience in his class had been the most important of my life, that I hoped to emulate his dedication if I could not match his genius, that I felt, as I felt he felt, alone with my unmentionable ideas, that I certainly could not join the political right, it was made of intellectual thugs and drones, nor the left, of course, either, since liberals were humanists at heart, and humanists were vain about the value of man, foolish about his so-called higher, better nature, and hypocrites about their equalitarian causes. I told him I hoped never to marry. I hoped to teach, as he had, the truth no matter what, namely that the truth was a snare. I said I hated the Reds. I said that my melancholy had brought me to the edge. I wondered who the women were who were taking care of him. I hoped he could eat. Did he sleep? Were the days long? Was he in pain? Did they change the sheets? Why was the window waxy? The floors seemed clean. Had this building been a schloss? It was time for me to leave. I still had that accent he made fun of. Perhaps he had noticed that. I had ridden out on my bike. Riding was probably good for me. Were they getting him everything he wanted? Did anyone read to him, show him magazines? Would he like a phonograph brought in? Did he ever see the papers? Did he sleep? I should let him get some rest. I would never marry. I was miserable and afraid to leave. I hated every journey, especially journeys home. Autos made me sick. Trains made me giddy. The sheets seemed crisply starched, but were they possibly too stiff? How did he communicate with the nuns? Nuns, I said, gave me the creeps, all that black. These women, though, wore white. Was that a comfort, that they resembled ordinary nurses? Did he have a routine? Did his doctor visit him in the mornings? Did he take the same medicines every hour? Why wasn't there a better light? The door was awfully heavy, more like the door of a cell. Had he ever read Henry Adams? Did he still have the same opinion about the Jews? I could not say, as it's been said of some, that he was a crank without a quirk, for Tabor was as quirky as they can't come. Bent from birth, I'm sure, into odd behaviors, some of which were only known to me near the end, when I visited him more frequently, and would sometimes watch him spill his tea in order to slurp the slips, or place a spoon on his saucer to listen to the silver rattle, or light matches to observe the waver of the flame. One's dying, he said, ought to entertain. I ought, I thought, to remain in this room with the Magus instead of consorting with my memories of him and his decline. First Tabor with the little limp, that tremor in the open palms I took to be a sign of his friendship with Schnapps, the slight shake in the voice I put down to emotion, then the spells of falling down when his limbs splayed suddenly like a raggedy man, followed by spasms which would travel across him like a frightened wire. The arm which would jerk so it lifted coffee from his cup, the wringing of his face, painful to observe, like a damp towel squeezing out its sop. The heavy speech which accompanied this, its hoos, hoots, and whistles, as his lungs writhed in his chest like weasels caged together. Weeks before, when he could still talk, although his voice shook as if he were riding a train, I had gone to visit him in his few full rooms to find the bed he lay in behind the barrier of his books, wiggle my way in between stacks of mags and heaped-up papers, coffee cans stuffed with rolls of manuscript, an umbrella at the bottom of his bed like a bolster, the floor slippery with loose sheets, picture postcards, shillings, socks, and buttons. There were bald papers he used to kick, overturned study lamps. Now he crawled about on a par with the rats. I could write another book, he would brag, on the dust on my discards. What would that book be, I asked, with a smile of the only sort he permitted, serious without being sober. Ah, you want to know about my dusk book, yes? My book, as you would say in English, about the drying day. Now he'd grin and grimace. They were a blend. There is the wet death. There is the dry. At death, there are two destinations for the soul, which for this myth we shall assume is still alive. The heaven of air, the hell of fire. The four forces do not form a square of elemental oppositions, as was formerly supposed, but an oblong like a Pullman, isn't it? Pullman train. The wet death passes through hell as steam. The dry death blows like pollen through the cities of the sky to make the residents sneeze. God bless is said by a multitude no one cares is infinite. His laugh would burst out like a child from school, but only for a moment, caught and stifled like a cough, covered by a cloth. My dry book would be about the sapless, about the loss of juice, about eyes which cannot cry, about noses which cannot run, about deserts and the boring mobilities of sand, of the dry life which can only run out, never rot, which can come apart but never decay. It would be the life and death of persons then like puzzles who are made only of small parts, of pieces, and whose reality rests on what is juxtaposed. Next to next makes their nest. He laughed his usual laugh. With these, death plays at jackstraws, lifting each element from among the others without the sign of a shiver from the pile. He laughed. I was transfixed, bidding adieu in the doorway, saying my last say. He laughed. Out of that shuffling, writhing encirclement of limbs had come a laugh, as in old times. His ha, derisive, questioning, a point of pause. All the accents struck like proper bells. He had laughed and fallen face forward on the coverlet. Yet it was not his laugh. How could it be? It was not the last laugh. There would be others. It was its laugh. Laugh, as though it had come from a dirty corner. I forced myself to approach him, to try somehow to pick Tabor from his overfold and place him upright anywhere flat, as you would a tipped top. His skin is cold, yet alive as a snake's. I'm afraid I squeamishly groaned. But as if summoned, the lady of qualified mercy was there, Meg's name for an earlier nurse, brusquely pushing past me to slip her hands under his head. "He does this a lot," she rather pleasantly said, turning what could only be called his skull, though it was jumping like a bean, to cheek side. "This is why he can still breathe." I muttered my apologies. "He does it on purpose," she said pleasantly. "He will die in terrible fear of God if he doesn't do something about it. Prepare his soul, I mean." "Will he do something about it?" I asked in considerable wonderment. "We shall have to do it for him, I suppose," the nun nurse said, pulling him upright on the bed and wrapping the sheet tightly about his person. It did seem to slow his spasms. "As you can see," she said, "he can't do much on his own behalf. The bishop may take a personal interest." The bishop himself, I thought, to save the atheist who is no longer mentis? Have they a waterfall for that? Some sort of after-the-fact baptismal drench which can be blended with unctions, redemptive mumbos, and sprinkles? Meg had lived like a wet, full of energy and excess, but I was not sure he had not died a dry, like a handful of seeds on a shaken tambourine. And were he to cross that threshold while I stood here at his, would I hear the hiss of steam which hell would heat his soul to, or would I suddenly sneeze as the spores of him passed without further fuss into heaven's handsomely unfurnished outer space? Maybe what I saw when I saw Mad Meg writhe was his body grappling with this question as his mind had wrestled with it earlier. And if the contest went on in this new arena as long and furiously as it had in the old, then poor Magus Tabor would jerk about and wiggle for what would surely seem an interminable period, repeating past gasps and grips and knotty gatherings before his queries were wearied out and he was allowed, as they say, to breathe his last. Well, I had one thing at least to hold on to, as well as one relief. I had that laugh to serve as my empty answer, and the comfort of knowing that among his many memento mori, there'd be no death mask. Thank you very much.